Liberty by John Stuart Mill, first published in 1859. This reading is based on a text at the website www.earlymoderntexts.com. Reader, Mill Nicholson. Chapter 1, Introduction. The subject of this essay is not the so-called liberty of the will that is unfortunately opposed to the misnamed doctrine of philosophical necessity. That is, I shan't be writing about anything like the issue between free will and determinism. My topic is civil or social liberty, the nature and limits of the power that society can legitimately exercise over the individual. This question is seldom posed, and almost never discussed in general terms. Yet it lurks behind many of the practical controversies of our day, profoundly influencing them, and is likely soon to make itself recognized as the vital question of the future. This isn't a new issue. Indeed, it has, in a certain sense, divided mankind almost from the earliest times. But given the progress the more civilized parts of humanity have made, it comes up under new conditions, and needs a different and more fundamental treatment. The struggle between liberty and authority is the most conspicuous feature of the parts of history that go furthest back, particularly in the histories of Greece, Rome, and England. But in olden times, this contest was between subjects, or some classes of them, and the government. By liberty was meant protection against the tyranny of the political rulers. Except in some of the democratic governments of Greece, the rulers were seen as inevitably antagonists of the people they ruled. They consisted of a single governing person, or a governing tribe or caste, who derived their authority from inheritance or conquest, or at any rate not from the consent of the governed, and whose supremacy men didn't risk challenging, and perhaps didn't want to challenge, whatever precautions might be taken against its being used oppressively. Their power was regarded as necessary, but also as highly dangerous, because it was a weapon that they would try to use against their subjects as much as against external enemies. To prevent the weaker members of the community from being preyed on by innumerable vultures, there needed to be a predator stronger than the rest, whose job was to keep the vultures down. But as the king of the vultures would be just as intent on preying on the flock as would any of the minor predators, the subjects had to be in a perpetual attitude of defence against his beak and claws. So the aim of patriots was to set limits to the power that the ruler should be allowed to have over the community, and this limitation was what they meant by liberty. They tried to achieve it in two ways. First, by getting certain political liberties or rights to be recognised. If the ruler were to infringe these, that would be regarded as a breach of duty, and particular resistance or general rebellion would be regarded as justifiable. A second, later approach was to establish constitutional checks according to which some of the governing power's more important acts required the consent of the community, or of a body supposed to represent its interests. In most European countries, the ruling power was more or less compelled to submit to the first of these kinds of limitation. Not so with the second. And the principal object of the lovers of liberty everywhere came to be getting this constitutional limit on the ruler's power or, when they already had it to some extent, achieving it more completely. And so long as mankind were content to fight off one enemy with help from another enemy, and to be ruled by a master on condition of a fairly effective guarantee against his tyranny, they didn't aim at anything more than this. But a time came in the progress of human affairs when men stopped thinking that their governors must inevitably be an independent power, with interests opposed to their own. It appeared to them much better that the various officers of the state should be their appointees, their delegates, who could be called back from office at the people's pleasure. Only in that way, it seemed, could people be completely assured that the powers of government would never be misused to their disadvantage. This new demand, to have rulers who were elected and temporary, became the prominent aim of the Democratic Party, wherever any such party existed, and it largely replaced the previous efforts to limit the power of rulers. As the struggle proceeded for making the ruling power come from the choice of the ruled, some people started to think that too much importance had been attached to limiting the power itself. The thought was this: limitations on the power of government is something to be used against rulers whose interests are habitually opposed to those of the people. What we now want is for the rulers to be identified with the people, for their interests and decisions to be the interests and decisions of the nation. The nation doesn't need to be protected against its own will. There is no fear of its tyrannizing over itself. As long as the rulers are responsible to the nation and easily removable by it, it can risk trusting them with power. The ruler's power is simply the nation's own power, concentrated and in a form convenient for use. This way of thinking, or perhaps rather of feeling, was common among the last generation of European liberalism, and apparently it still predominates in Europe, outside Britain. Those who would set any limit to what may be done by a government stand out as brilliant exceptions among the political thinkers of continental Europe. A similar attitude might by now have been prevalent in our own country, if it weren't for a change in the circumstances that for a time encouraged it. But in political and philosophical theories, as well as in persons, success reveals faults and weaknesses that failure might have hidden from view. The notion that the people needn't limit their power over themselves might seem self-evident at a time when democratic government was only dreamed of or read about as having existed in the distant past, and that notion wasn't disturbed by such temporary aberrations as those of the French Revolution, the worst of which were the doing of a few usurpers, people who grabbed power without being entitled to it, and which in any case didn't come from the permanent working of institutions among the people, but from a sudden explosion against monarchical and aristocratic despotism. In time, however, a democratic republic came to occupy much of the earth's surface, and made itself felt as one of the most powerful members of the community of nations, and elected and responsible government became subject to the scrutiny and criticisms that any great existing fact is likely to draw on itself. It was now seen that such phrases as self-government and the people's power over themselves don't express the true state of the case. The people who exercise the power aren't always the ones over whom it is exercised, and the self-government spoken of is the government not of each by himself, but of each by all the rest. The will of the people in practice means the will of the most numerous or the most active part of the people, that is, the majority, or those who get themselves accepted as the majority. So the people may desire to oppress some of their number, and precautions are as much needed against this as against any other abuse of power. Thus the limitation of government's power over individuals loses none of its importance when the holders of power are regularly accountable to the community, i.e. to the strongest party in it. This view of things recommends itself equally to the intelligence of thinkers and to the desires of the important groups in European society, whose real or supposed interests democracy opposes. So it has had no difficulty in establishing itself, and in political theorizing, the tyranny of the majority is now generally included among the evils that society should guard against. Like other tyrannies, the tyranny of the majority was at first feared primarily as something that would operate through the acts of the public authorities, and this is how the man in the street still sees it. But thoughtful people saw that society itself can be the tyrant, society collectively tyrannizing over individuals within it, and that this kind of tyranny isn't restricted to what society can do through the acts of its political government. Society can and does enforce its own commands, and if it issues wrong commands, or any commands on matters that it oughtn't to meddle with at all, it practices a social tyranny that is more formidable than many kinds of political oppression. Although it isn't usually upheld by such extreme penalties, it leaves fewer means of escape, penetrating much more deeply into the details of life, and enslaving the soul itself. So protection against the tyranny of government isn't enough. There needs to be protection also against the tyranny of prevailing opinion and feeling, against the tendency of society to turn its own ideas and practices into rules of conduct, and impose them, by means other than legal penalties, on those who dissent from them, to hamper the development and, if possible, to prevent the formation of any individuality that isn't in harmony with its ways. There is a limit to how far collective opinion can legitimately interfere with individual independence, and finding and defending that limit is as indispensable to human welfare as is protection against political despotism. But though this proposition isn't likely to be disputed in general terms, the practical question of where to place the limit, how to make the right adjustment between individual independence and social control, is a subject on which nearly all the work remains to be done. Everything that makes life worth living for anyone depends on restraints being put on the actions of other people. So some rules of conduct must be imposed, in the first place by law, and by public opinion on many things that aren't suitable for bringing under law. What should these rules be? That is the principal question in human affairs, but with a few obvious exceptions, it is one that least progress has been made in resolving. It hasn't been answered in the same way in any two historical periods, and hardly ever in two countries in the same period. And the answer of one period or country is a source of amazement to another. Yet the people in any given country, at any given time, don't see any problem here. It's as though they believed that mankind had always held the same view about what the rules should be. The rules that hold in their society appear to them to be self-evident and self-justifying. This almost universal illusion is one example of the magical influence of custom. The effect of custom in preventing any doubts concerning the rules of conduct that mankind impose on one another is made all the more complete by the fact that this isn't something that is generally thought to require reasons, whether for someone to give to others or to give to himself. People are accustomed to believing that on such topics their feelings are better than reasons, and make it unnecessary to have reasons. The practical principle that leads them to their opinions about how one should behave is the feeling, in each person's mind, that everybody should be required to act as he, and those who feel as he does, would like them to act. Of course, no one admits to himself that his standard of judgment is what he likes. But when an opinion on how people should behave isn't supported by reasons, it can count only as one person's preference. And if reasons are given, and turn out to be a mere appeal to a similar preference felt by other people, it is still only a matter of liking, the likes of many people, instead of one person. To an ordinary man, however, his own preference, with other people sharing it, is not only a perfectly satisfactory reason, but is the only reason he has for most of his notions of morality, taste, or propriety, except for notions that are explicitly written in his religious creed, and even that is something he interprets mainly in the light of his personal preferences. Men's opinions about what is praiseworthy or blameable are affected by all the various causes that influence their wishes concerning the conduct of others. And these causes are as numerous as those that influence their wishes on any other subject. It may be any of these: their reason, their prejudices or superstitions, their social feelings, their antisocial feelings, envy or jealousy, arrogance or contempt, their desires or fears for themselves, their legitimate or illegitimate self-interest. The last of these is the most common. In any country that has a dominant class, a large portion of the morality of the country emanates from that class, from its interests and its feelings of class superiority. The morality between Spartans and slave warriors, between planters and negroes, between monarchs and subjects, between nobles and peasants, between men and women, has mostly been created by these class interests and feelings. On the other hand, where a class has lost its dominant position, or where its dominance is unpopular, the prevailing moral sentiments frequently show the marks of an impatient dislike of any kind of dominance. Rules of conduct, both positive and negative, that have been enforced by law or opinion, have also been influenced by mankind's servile attitude towards the supposed likes or dislikes of their worldly masters or of their gods. This servility is essentially selfish, but it isn't hypocrisy. It gives rise to perfectly genuine sentiments of abhorrence, such as have made men burn magicians and heretics. Along with so many baser influences, the general and obvious interests of society have of course had a share, a large share, in the direction of the moral sentiments. But they have played this role not so much by serving directly as reasons for this or that moral view, as by causing various likes and dislikes which lead to this or that moral view. And other likes and dislikes, ones having little or nothing to do with the interests of society, have affected the establishment of moralities with quite as much force as the former ones. The likes and dislikes of society, or of some powerful part of it, are thus the main determinant of the rules that societies have laid down for general observance under the penalties of law or of opinion. And those whose thoughts and feelings have been ahead of those of society in general have not attacked this state of things in principle, however much they may have clashed with some of its details. They have been busier inquiring into what things society ought to like or dislike than in questioning whether society's likes or dislikes should be a law for individuals. They have tried to alter the feelings of mankind on the particular points on which they themselves were heretical, i.e., out of step with society, rather than making common cause with heretics generally in defence of freedom. The only case in which the higher ground has been taken on principle and maintained with consistency by more than a few individuals is that of religious belief, and this is instructive in several ways, partly because it provides a most striking instance of the fallibility of what is called the moral sense. It really is the moral sense that is involved, for the religious hatred felt by a sincere bigot is one of the most unambiguous cases of moral feeling. Those who first broke the yoke of what called itself the Universal Church were in general no more willing to permit differences of religious opinion than was that church itself. But when the heat of the conflict was cooled without giving a complete victory to any party, and each church or sect saw that the most it could hope for was to hold the ground it already occupied, minorities were compelled to plead to those whom they could not convert for permission to differ. They had to do this because they saw no chance of becoming majorities. So it is on this battlefield, and hardly anywhere else, that the individual's rights against society have been asserted on broad grounds of principle, and society's claim to exercise authority over dissentients has been openly challenged. The great writers to whom the world owes what religious liberty it possesses have mostly asserted freedom of conscience as a right that can't be taken away, and have flatly denied that a human being is accountable to others for his religious belief. Yet mankind are so naturally intolerant over anything they really care about that real religious freedom has existed hardly anywhere, except where religious indifference has weighed in on the side of it, merely because it dislikes having its peace disturbed by theological quarrels. In the minds of almost all religious persons, even in the most tolerant countries, the duty of toleration is admitted with unspoken reservations. One person will put up with dissent in matters of church government, but not of dogma. Another can tolerate anyone except a Roman Catholic or a Unitarian. A third tolerates everyone who believes in revealed religion, but not those whose religious beliefs are based on arguments and evidence rather than on revelation. A few extend their charity a little further, but won't tolerate those who don't believe in a God and in a future state. Wherever the sentiment of the majority is still genuine and intense, it gives a wide scope to its claim to be obeyed. The yoke of opinion may be heavier in England than in most other countries of Europe, but our yoke of law is lighter. This is because of the special facts of English political history. Here there is considerable resentment of direct interference with private conduct by the legislative or the executive power. Though this comes not so much from any proper respect for the independence of the individual, as from the continuing tendency to see the government as standing for interests opposite to the public's. The majority haven't yet learned to feel the power of the government as being their power, or its opinions as being their opinions. When they do so, individual liberty will probably be as vulnerable to invasion from the government as it already is from public opinion. But up to now, there has been considerable opposition to any attempt by the law to bring in new controls over individuals. This happens with very little careful thought about whether the matter is within the legitimate sphere of legal control, so that the feeling against government interference, though highly beneficial on the whole, may in particular cases be misplaced quite as often as it is well grounded. There is, in fact, no recognized principle that is generally used to decide whether a given item of government interference is proper. People decide in individual cases according to their personal preferences. Some, whenever they see any good to be done or evil to be remedied, are willing for the government to do something about it, while others would put up with almost any amount of social evil rather than add anything to the scope of government control over human life. And men choose sides in any particular case according to this general direction, for or against governmental control, of their sentiments, or to how much they feel their own interests to be involved in the matter in question, or to whether they think that the government would settle the matter in the way they prefer, but very rarely on the basis of any firm, considered opinion about what things are fit to be done by a government. And it seems to me that because of this absence of rule or principle, one side is wrong as often as the other. The interference of government is improperly supported and improperly condemned with about equal frequency. The object of this essay is to assert one very simple principle, and to argue that it should absolutely govern how society deals with its individual members in matters involving compulsion and control, whether through physical force, in the form of legal penalties, or through the moral coercion of public opinion. The principle is this: the only end for which people are entitled, individually or collectively, to interfere with the liberty of action of any of their number is self-protection. The only purpose for which power can be rightfully exercised over any member of a civilized community against his will is to prevent harm to others. The person's own good, whether physical or moral, isn't a sufficient ground for interference with his conduct. He cannot rightfully be compelled to do, or not do, something because doing it or not doing it would be better for him, would make him happier, would be wise in the opinions of others, or would be right. These are good reasons for protesting to him, reasoning with him, persuading him, or begging him, but not for compelling him or for punishing him if he acts otherwise. To justify compulsion or punishment, the conduct in question must be likely to bring harm to someone else. The only part of anyone's conduct for which he is answerable to society is the part that concerns others. In the part that concerns himself alone, he is entitled to absolute independence over himself, over his own body and mind. The individual is sovereign. I hardly need say that this doctrine is meant to apply only to human beings when they have reached the age of maturity. We aren't speaking of children, or of young persons below the age legally fixed for adulthood. Those who still need to be taken care of by others must be protected against their own actions, as well as against external injury. For the same reason, we may exclude those backward states of society in which the race itself may be considered as not yet adult. The early difficulties in the way of progress are so great that there is seldom any choice of means for overcoming them. For dealing with barbarians, despotism is a legitimate form of government, provided that it aims to improve things and actually does so. liberty, as a principle, doesn't apply to any situation where mankind are not yet capable of being improved by free and equal discussion. Until then, there is nothing for them but implicit obedience to an Akbar or a Charlemagne, if they are so fortunate as to find a despot so wise. But in all the nations I am concerned with here, the people long ago became capable of self-improvement through conviction or persuasion. And once that stage has been reached, compulsion is no longer admissible as a means to their own good, and is justifiable only for the security of others. I am talking here about direct physical compulsion, and compulsion through penalties for non-compliance. It might seem easier for me to defend my position if I took this stance: it is just objectively, abstractly right that people should be free, never mind what the consequences of their freedom are. But I don't argue in that way, because I hold that the ultimate appeal on all ethical questions is to utility, i.e. to what the consequences are. However, it must be utility in the broadest sense, based on the permanent interests of man as a progressive being. Those interests, I contend, make it all right to subject individual spontaneity to external control only in respect to actions that affect the interests of people other than the actor. If anyone does something harmful to others, there is a prima facie case for punishing him, either by law or, where legal penalties are not safely applicable, by general disapproval. There are also many positive acts for the benefit of others that an individual may rightfully be compelled to perform: to give evidence in a court of justice, to do his fair share in the defence of his country, or to share in any other joint work necessary to the interests of the society whose protection he enjoys, and to perform certain acts of individual beneficence. For example, a man may rightfully be held to account by society for not saving a fellow creature's life, or not protecting a defenceless person against ill treatment, in situations where it was obvious that he ought to have done so. A person may cause harm to others not only by his actions, but also by his inaction, and either way he is justly accountable to them for the harm. The latter case, it is true, requires a much more cautious exercise of compulsion than the former. To make someone answerable for doing harm to others is the rule. To make him answerable for not preventing harm is, comparatively speaking, the exception. Yet there are many cases, clear enough and serious enough, to justify that exception. In everything concerning the external relations of the individual, he is legally answerable to those whose interests are concerned, and if necessary, to society as their protector. There are often good reasons for not holding him to that responsibility, but these reasons must arise from special features of the case. Either it is a case where he is likely to act better when left to himself than when controlled in any way that society could control him, or the attempt to exercise control would have bad effects outweighing those it would prevent. When such reasons as these rule out the enforcement of responsibility, the person's own conscience should take on the role of judge, and protect the interests of others that have no external protection. But there is a sphere of action in which the interests of society, as distinct from those of the individual, are involved only indirectly, if they are involved at all. It is the sphere containing all the part of the individual's life and conduct that affects only himself, or affects others, but only with their free, voluntary, and undeceived consent and participation. When I say affects only himself, I'm talking about the direct and immediate effects of his conduct. These may, of course, affect others indirectly, through their effects on himself. So this is the appropriate region of human liberty. I map it as containing three provinces. The first is the inward domain of consciousness, demanding liberty of conscience in the broadest sense, liberty of thought and feeling, absolute freedom of opinion and sentiment on all subjects, practical or theoretical, scientific, moral or theological, and liberty of expressing and publishing opinions. This last may seem to belong under a different principle, since it involves conduct that affects other people, but it can't in practice be separated from the liberty of thought. It is almost as important as that, and rests in great part on the same reasons. The second domain is the liberty of tastes and pursuits, of shaping our life to suit our own character, of doing what we like. All this without hindrance from our fellow creatures, so long as what we do doesn't harm them, even though they may think our conduct foolish, perverse, or wrong. Thirdly, following from the first two domains of liberty, there is the liberty of individuals to unite for any purpose not involving harm to others, always supposing that the people in question are of full age and aren't being forced or deceived. No society in which these liberties are not mainly respected is free, whatever its form of government, and none is completely free in which they don't exist absolute and unqualified. The only freedom that deserves the name is the freedom to pursue our own good in our own way, so long as we don't try to deprive others of their good, or hinder their efforts to obtain it. Each person is the proper guardian of his own health of body, mind, and spirit. Mankind gain more from allowing each other to live in the way that seems good to themselves than they would gain from compelling each to live in the way that seems good to the rest. This doctrine is far from new, and it may strike some as a mere truism, but in fact it is directly opposed to the general tendency of existing opinion and practice. Society has put as much effort into trying, according to its lights, to compel people to conform to its notions of personal excellence, as into trying to compel them to conform to its notions of social excellence. The ancient commonwealths thought, and the ancient philosophers agreed, that every part of private conduct could rightly be regulated by public authority, on the ground that the state's welfare involved the whole bodily and mental discipline of each citizen. This way of thinking may have been admissible in small republics surrounded by powerful enemies, in constant peril of being pulled down by foreign attack or internal upheavals, so that even a short period of relaxation and leaving the people to themselves might easily be fatal, so easily that they couldn't afford to wait for the beneficial permanent effects of freedom. In the modern world, two factors have prevented the law from interfering so much in the details of private life: the greater size of political communities, and, above all, the separation between the spiritual and temporal authority, i.e., between church and state, which placed the direction of men's consciences in hands other than those that control their worldly affairs. But the engines of moral, as distinct from political repression, that have been wielded against divergence from the prevailing opinion and attitudes, have put less energy into this in social matters than in personal, private, self-regarding conduct. A reason for this is that religion, the most powerful of the elements that have contributed to forming moral feeling, has almost always been governed either by the ambition of a hierarchy seeking control over every department of human conduct, or by the spirit of Puritanism. But that isn't the whole story. For some of the modern reformers who have most strongly opposed the religions of the past have been right up there with the churches and sects in asserting their right to spiritual domination. A prime example is Monsieur Comte, whose social system, as proposed in his System of Positive Polity, aims at establishing, though more by moral than by legal pressures, a despotism of society over the individual that surpasses anything contemplated in the political idea of the most rigid disciplinarian among the ancient philosophers. Apart from the special views of individual thinkers, there is also in the world at large an increasing inclination to stretch unduly the powers of society over the individual, through the force both of opinion and of legislation, and because the tendency of all the changes taking place in the world is to strengthen society and lessen the power of the individual, this encroachment is not one of the evils that tends spontaneously to disappear, but on the contrary, it tends to grow more and more formidable. Mankind have some disposition, whether as rulers or as fellow citizens, to impose their own opinions and inclinations as a rule of conduct on others. This disposition is so energetically supported by some of the best and some of the worst feelings in human nature, that it is hardly ever restrained by anything except lack of power, and the power of societies is not declining, but growing. So unless a strong barrier of moral conviction can be raised against the mischief of meddling with individual liberty, we must expect, given the way the world is, to see it increase. It will be convenient for the argument if, instead of plunging immediately into the general thesis, we confine ourselves at first to a single branch of it, a branch on which current opinions, to some extent, recognize the general principle I am defending. This one branch is the liberty of thought, from which it is impossible to separate the related liberty of speaking and of writing. These liberties form a considerable part of the political morality of all countries that profess religious toleration and free institutions, but the philosophical and practical grounds on which they rest are perhaps not as familiar to people in general, or as thoroughly grasped, even by many of the leaders of opinion, as might have been expected. Those grounds, when rightly understood, also apply to other divisions of our subject, and a thorough consideration of this part of the question is the best introduction to the remainder. So I hope you'll forgive me, if nothing that I am about to say is new to you, as I embark on yet one more discussion of something that has often been discussed over the past 3 centuries. End of chapter 1.